This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The definition, diagnosis, and recommended treatment for some medical disorders are in the process of revision. After 16 years, the American Psychiatric Association wants to update the Bible of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, universally known as the DSM. The new draft of DSM-5 includes important changes to bipolar disorder, binge eating, autism, and substance abuse, changes that affect not only mental health professionals and their patients, but the insurance companies that also use the DSM as a guide. Over the years, the DSM has generated controversy and criticism for what it defines as a medical disorder and what it doesn't. For example, homosexuality used to be listed as a disorder. And the draft has been put out for comment from healthcare professionals and from the public. So here's your chance. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. How would these changes affect you? You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Later in the program, post-earthquake triage with a Baltimore ER doctor just back from Haiti. But first, Dr. David Kupfer, who chairs the DSM-5 Task Force, joins us from his home in Pittsburgh, where he's also a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. And nice to have you with us today. I know you're snowed in. Appreciate you taking the time.
Well, not a problem. Thank you, Neil. If I could just reinforce what you've just pointed out. As you indicated, the last update to the DSM was in 1994, and there's been a tremendous amount of research since that time. There's also been, I think, a clarity with respect to the fact that a number of diagnoses did really not work well in real-life practice. And why were patients being diagnosed as often with NOS, not otherwise specified?
Mm-hmm.
So we are really hoping that the criteria update, which is a proposed set of updates, would be more useful for clinicians and more accurately diagnose these patients.
And let's get to that proposed thing. These are proposed revisions. This draft has been put out for comment. It would not take effect until after you've had a chance to see what people say and then perhaps rewrite it again.
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen. We're going to go through a process, really, which I think is probably unprecedented, of after 2 months reviewing all the commentary that comes from professionals and the public and patients and families, and re-examined what we have as proposed criteria. We'll be conducting some field trials in selected disorders to see how reliable some of these changes that we've proposed work out and how clinically useful and adaptable they are. Then we will probably have another public review of all this information before we really begin writing the final set of criteria and the text that goes with it, because in essence, this will not really be published officially until 2013.
Well,
so we're hoping that this is a really important iterative process which will allow everybody to, in a sense, weigh in.
Well, what are some of the big areas where you and your colleagues looked at practice and what was happening and saying, look, we got some problems here. This is where we need to focus.
Well, clearly we have some problems. And some of those problems are really across the entire age spectrum. I know that later on in the program, and really there have been two terrific stories already this morning on areas that relate to really childhood and adolescence, and that's the Asperger issue with respect to autism spectrum and certainly pediatric bipolar. But there are other areas that we felt, if you will, needed a lot of attention, and that's why there are proposals and even major proposals for changes. They include, for example, binge eating, which has been in the appendix of DSM-4, but we really feel at this point there's enough research and evidence to warrant its inclusion in the main manual.
Mm-hmm.
Issues of, for example, DSM-4 used the term mental retardation. There is important changes in the use of that term, and language is important. And so, for example, not only will we propose the use of intellectual disability, but we've included a number of criteria changes there to be more precise with when that diagnosis is appropriate. Another area which I think is extremely important is this whole area of substance use and dependence. And there we've proposed a new category, which is addiction and related disorders. And this will include substance use disorders, with each drug identified in its own category. But we will eliminate the category of dependence, which will give, I think, both clinicians and patients a better understanding of responses of tolerance or withdrawal when individuals are using prescribed medications. Also coming out of this whole area of addictions is really the sense that there are behavioral addictions. We are recommending that perhaps gambling addiction be included in the main manual. There are several other...
And that would obviously not be substance, and so that's one of the reasons for the change in the definition.
Exactly. So yeah. What we would be talking about is really both what we would call drug or chemical and behavioral addictions, because there's a very interesting set of neuroscience findings over the past 10 years which are suggesting that perhaps some of the underlying physiology and pathophysiology of these addictive disorders may not be terribly different between some of the behavioral addictions and the so-called, what I would call, drug addictions.
Well, let's start getting some of that public comment that you've asked for. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Mark is on the line with us from Lexington in Kentucky.
Yes, I would just like to say that over the years I have worked with psychiatric patients, and over the years I've seen many patients come in against their will. And psychiatrists will typically find some sort of diagnosis in the DSM-4 that would fit just basically a personality trait. And I was thinking that maybe they should limit the amount of the entries in the DSM-4 to where psychiatrists don't necessarily have to pinpoint some sort of diagnosis for every patient they saw. As a matter of fact, I think over the 4 or 5 years I worked in psychiatry, only a handful of patients that were brought in against their will many times left without a diagnosis from the DSM-4. I think it's just too broad of a book that needs to be a little narrowed down.
Well, Neil, can I respond to that?
Please go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that question. It gives me an opportunity to talk about one of the other issues that we have grappled with, which is this issue of, if you will, lumping things together or splitting. Certainly, we're not interested in creating more diagnoses than currently exist in the DSM-4. And the issue of personality and personality disorders has been something that has been of considerable work and interest to the group that's been working on personality. And it is very likely, again, if one would go to the DSM website, you would see that what we are proposing is really one central diagnosis of personality disorders, rather than having the multiple personality disorder categories that we had previously. What we hope this will do, if you would go to it, you would see that what we're describing is ways of talking about levels of severity and ways of assessing in a more precise way, such that not everybody, quote, who has a personality trait is going to get a case diagnosis. And so I really agree with you that certainly this was where we were going with really it was in this. There are several important areas where we need to be much more precise. We need to provide better assessments for clinicians. We need to be able to provide better information for patients and their families. And so therefore, we're in a much better position to, if you will, deal with appropriate interventions.
Mark, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And Dr. Kupfer was kind enough to mention reports that you've been hearing on NPR about two of the big areas, and that terms autism and child's diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And we've got the authors of those studies, those reports here with us in the studio. Those are Elise Spiegel, NPR science correspondent, and John Hamilton, also NPR science correspondent. John, you've been focusing on autism, and the there used to be in DSM-4, there's a category called Asperger's disorder, and that's now going to be lumped in with a bunch of other things in a spectrum of autism.
Right. It will be called the Autism Spectrum Disorder, and it includes not just Asperger's, but several other what used to be sort of subcategories of autism. And as Dr. Kupfer was saying, the point here is to try to put things into that are similar into one category, and then worry about severity of the symptoms rather than in having all these different buckets to put things in.
And as you mentioned in your report, there are some people who have been diagnosed with Asperger's say, "Wait a minute, this has a distinguished tradition." There have been great people who've been known to have Asperger's, and suddenly we're lumped in with some people who have very severe disorders.
Yeah, this is a bit troubling for some people who have taken pride in, and many of them call themselves Aspies or part of the Aspie community. And in fact, there have been, you know, famous people. Some of great intellectuals would have been diagnosed with Asperger's. So for these people, it's troubling. Although it's interesting, I spent a lot of time today reading through blogs where people with Asperger's weigh in, and it's very mixed. There are a lot of them that say, you know what, I've looked at the scientific evidence. And I think that we probably are all on the spectrum, and it's appropriate to put us there.
Lee Spiegel, let me turn to you. And there has been an explosion of the number of children diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and some of the changes in this new draft of the DSM are directed to that.
Right. They want to create, or they are trying to create, a new category called temper dysregulation disorder. And they are doing that, for exactly as you say, because they feel like too many children have been misdiagnosed as bipolar when they are not really.
Because that's the only thing that was available to the psychiatrist under the in the old DSM?
Well, what happened was, I mean, the explosion of bipolar really dates to kind of 1995. And there was this woman named Janet Wozniak who was working in this famous psychiatrist lab. And his name was Joseph Biederman. And she was looking at kids with ADHD who really had problems with temper. And like these terrible temper outbursts. And she interpreted the real problem with these kids was not that they had impulse control problems, because kids with ADHD sometimes have impulse control problems, but that they had problems with their moods. But in order to make that argument, and here this is what the people in the DSM say, in order to make that argument, she actually had to change the traditional definition of bipolar. So before, to get categorized as bipolar, you needed to have episodes of mania, but she said the children don't have those kinds of episodes. They just have daily episodes. So that was a change.
This is what we're trying to address in the new draft of the DSM. Elise Spiegel and John Hamilton will stay with us. Also, more with Dr. David Kupfer, chair of the DSM-5 Task Force. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. We want to hear some of that comment from the mental health professionals and the public on this proposed revision to this very important document. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A new draft of the Psychiatrist's Bible, or the DSM as it's known, was released by the American Psychiatric Association today. The DSM is used by mental health care professionals, from psychiatrists to your insurance company, to diagnose and classify mental disorders. We're talking about why the changes are proposed, what they might mean, with NPR science correspondents Elise Spiegel and John Hamilton. Today also with us is Dr. David Kupfer, chair of the DSM-5 Task Force and a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We want to hear the comments that they hope to hear from mental health professionals and from the public. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Just before the break, we were talking about proposed changes in autism and Asperger's and also child bipolar disorder. And Dr. Kupfer, I know you had some comments.
Yes, both of these articles are excellent, as I've said before, and they highlight the fact that when we utilize all the scientific evidence and clinical trial and epidemiological data that was available, we came to the conclusion with respect to Asperger that there was not the scientific evidence to make that separate. And so it is much clearer now and reflects our current knowledge of making this one larger disorder, autism spectrum disorder. With respect to the bipolar set of issues, what we found in two longitudinal studies now is that the children who have temper tantrums, impulse behavior, and dysphoria that we've considered as this new syndrome have grown up to become individuals who develop anxiety and depressive disorders, not bipolar disorders. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that pediatric bipolar disorder, if you will, breeds truly.
Mm-hmm.
That these are individuals who are likely, if we don't intervene early, to have a lifetime illness, which we would consider bipolar disease.
Now let's get a caller in on the conversation. Scott joins us from Palo Alto.
Hi, very interesting discussion. I just was curious, seems like the insurance companies would have a lot at stake here, and I was just wondering, during the public comment period, How do they weigh in? Are you, is this committee lobbied by them, or how intensively are they lobbied by the insurance company?
It's written by psychiatrists for psychiatrists, but Dr. Kupfer, the insurance companies sure do use it, and do you take that into account?
Well, they certainly use it, and like everybody else who will be able to, in a sense, go on to the DSM site, we expect that we may get public commentary from the insurance companies.
But as Scott was asking, do the insurance companies play a role in decision-making? Are they part of the process?
They are not part of the process.
All right. Scott, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And how much, you know, it's really important to people because they can get, if it's in the DSM, they can get their insurance companies to pay for treatment of it. And so do you take that into account while you're writing this?
Well, we want to make sure that patients who have a need for intervention and are suffering and have a level of threshold where they have dysfunctioning and impairment deserve to receive care. That's the thing that is, in a sense, driving us, which is our patients and their families. With respect to where the threshold is of disorder, it's not simply a number of symptoms. And I think that that's also important, that when we are dealing with our diagnostic criteria, we are trying to find the appropriate thresholds of what we technically might call caseness, but it's really those individuals who are seeking help and who need it.
Dr. Kupfer, thanks so much for your time today. We know you're busy, and this is going to be an interesting process. We'll be checking back in with you through the years.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. David Kupfer is chair of the DSM-5 Task Force, professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And let's get some more callers on the line. Let's go to Stephen. Stephen with us from Tucson.
Hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Go ahead, please.
Hi. My name's Steve. I'm a licensed psychologist. I've worked with children primarily for the last 30 years as a special educator and a licensed psychologist. And I have to say, I really appreciate the work in the 90s with the diagnosis of children with bipolar disorder and how that kind of took off. Generally, bipolar disorder is thought of as a neurotransmitter imbalance, and psychologists have kind of been left out of the loop.
And does this redraft address your issues?
It does, and I'm appreciative of that. It, my colleagues and I discuss it, how we had kind of been left out of treatment of children who get diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
Uh-huh. Stephen, we're having trouble with your phone, so I'm going to have to let you go. But I will get a response from Elise Siegel.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Elise.
He was saying that he thought that the bipolar disorder was useful to him.
Yes.
And this new change essentially would, what they are trying to do is make it more difficult for people to give the bipolar label to children. They think
which
really
would allow psychologists
been
to work with some of these kids too.
Right.
Here's an email. This from Judy in Vermilion, South Dakota. My 9-year-old son was denied services in my state of South Dakota because he was diagnosed as PDDNOS, pervasive development disorder, not otherwise specified, a close relation to Asperger's. If he'd been diagnosed with autism, he would have received speech therapy, occupational therapy, and other services. This new designation will do wonders for many children like my own who were penalized under the previous DSM. Is that one of the things John Hamilton is meant to address?
Indeed it is. And in fact, a lot of the people that I spoke to who were looking at this were hoping exactly that thing would happen, is that kids who otherwise might have been dropped out of the system would be included because there is now a single diagnosis.
Let's go to Elizabeth. Elizabeth calling from Nashville.
Hi, my comment is similar to the email you just read in regard to special education services within the school system. And currently, a child that has an Asperger's or a PDD diagnosis does not have those extra supports within the school context that they would if they were diagnosed with autism, even though they're very closely related disorders.
And you're not concerned about the possibility of a kid who thought they had Asperger's now saying, oh, I've been painted with the broad brush of autism?
Having worked with autistic children, I don't foresee that as a problem, and I think it's something that will greatly benefit children on the entirety of the spectrum in social interactions and in their school environment.
Okay. Elizabeth, thanks very much. John?
One of the things that has been a problem with Asperger's specifically is that it's treated differently in different places in the country. So, for instance, California may have treats Asperger's separately, whereas other places may treat it more like autism. And I think one of the hopes here is that with single definition, there'll be more uniformity from place to place in this country.
It's interesting also, as we think of autism, a lot of people may have heard Temple Grandin, which he's been on this program or on Terry Gross's program, saw the movie about her that was on HBO just last weekend and realized what the spectrum of some of the differences of people's brains with autism really are. Anyway, let's get another caller on the line. Celeste is joining us from St. Louis.
Hi, this is Celeste.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm a psychiatry resident at Barnes Jewish Hospital at Washington University. My question was about the new DSM-5. I know that the DSM-3, this kind of broad changes in the field of psychiatry. I was wondering how this DSM will change the field of psychiatry.
Elise Spiegel?
I think one of the things that they were shooting for was a little more continuity. I mean, you mentioned the DSM-3. There was a huge change with the DSM-3 from the DSMs that were before that. They introduced all of these criteria. But there's been a focus, I think, in this DSM with, making it there have only been minor changes. Not minor changes, but they've tried to limit the number of changes that they had from the DSM-4.
Uh-huh. How will this change psychiatry residency, you think?
I'm not sure.
We'll have to wait to see how that works out. And Celeste, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go next to, this is Sarah. Sarah with us from Gillette in Wyoming.
Hi. First of all, I want to say thanks for taking my call. But I have a nephew who is autistic, and his mother is always trying to find different things to blame, and she doesn't believe that he's autistic, and she doesn't think that he has the symptoms, but he's clearly autistic. And I am really excited about this because I feel like if there's more symptoms listed, she might be able to finally understand that this is what he has and might be able to finally start working with him instead of ignoring it.
Well, John Hamilton, some people, there is avoidance and denial in some cases. Obviously, we don't know what the specifics are in this case. But nevertheless, is this new definition going to help parents of children understand what their children have?
It, in some cases, it will. I know one of the things that's been said among some of the people who have autism is that, there's a group of people out there who really have what we have, but they say, and parents for that matter, who say, my kid isn't autistic. They have Asperger's or they have pervasive developmental disorder, these mm-hmm. things. And in some ways, it clarifies things to just, instead of running around a label, just to say, okay, here's the broad category. And the real question is, where are the problems that they have trouble functioning? Is it just in social interactions, or is it in some sort of cognitive task? Where are the problems, not what is the label you put on it?
Okay. Sarah, thanks very much for the call, and we wish your family the best of luck.
Oh, thank you.
It sounds like you've got some kids of your own there.
Yeah, she's crawling around on the floor.
Well, try to keep up with her. It's not so easy. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
And let me turn to you, Elise Spiegel. Mm-hmm. And some people have concern, particularly with this number of children who, and in the past under the old DSM, have been diagnosed with bipolar disorder and the volume of powerful drugs that are being given to children who are quite young.
Yeah, that was one of the considerations that they talked about. The kids, even as young as 2 years old, are getting mood stabilizers and this drug called atypical antipsychotics. And essentially, we have no idea. The drugs haven't been tested in children for the most part, and we have no idea how this is going to affect them in the future when they're 40, how this will affect them.
Those longitudinal studies that
they haven't been done because, I mean, these drugs haven't really been used in kids until recently.
There's also the question of control groups. You want to do blind studies, give it to some and not to others, and ethical concerns come up there, too.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So is this addressed? How would that change under the proposed revision?
Well, it's a little bit hard to predict is the answer. I mean, I think, having talked to people who are behind the change, I think that they are hoping that by creating this new definition, people will be less quick to prescribe, psychiatrists will be less quick to prescribe the drugs for kids, and that they'll shift back towards, you know, more therapies, behavioral therapies, parenting advice. But it's impossible to say. I mean, the horse might be out of the barn on that one.
The American Psychiatric Association has issued a draft of its proposed revisions to the DSM, the Bible of Psychiatry. It's out for comment from the medical professionals and from the public. Those comments will be taken into account, and a final version will be out in 2013. We're talking with John Hamilton and Elise Spiegel, NPR science correspondents. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Larry in Independence, Missouri. While the DSM is useful for allowing consistency in treatment, it also has the negative effect of being a requirement for treatment. Modern scientific knowledge is not complete, and humans seem capable of demonstrating new behaviors as our environment changes, so it should not be surprising that some behaviors resist categorization. The negative side comes in when health insurance requires a hard diagnosis before providing coverage. And John, that's an issue that a lot of people bring up consistently with DSMs, past, present, and future.
Indeed. And I should say that with autism, you know, for the most part, we're not talking about private health insurance here, because there really isn't much private health insurance coverage for autism. It's not considered a medical disease that you can treat. Most of what we're talking about here has to do with getting support services from the government. It has to do with disability. It has to do with special education, mostly. But certainly the problems that people have had in the past have to do with the fact that the understanding of the disorders has changed. And you know, if this succeeds in being more precise in saying who's in, who's out, mm-hmm. it will have been a good thing.
Let's go to Jim. Jim calling from San Antonio.
Yeah. How are you doing there?
I'm well, thanks.
My question is more about mental health and the positive side. When I was in school, the DSM-4 revised edition was out. And obviously it's changed a lot since, but my main issue has been how there's never been a definition of what mental health is. Abraham Maslow did extensive research in that area, but all of his work has pretty much been completely ignored by the psychological community. And I think it would be great if they put a definition of what mental health is in the book.
Is that going to be addressed, Elise?
Mental health or mental disease?
No, mental health. In other words, they're defining a lot of things about what can go wrong. Are they saying, and here's a description of somebody who's, shall we say, sane?
I haven't heard that they're coming up with one anytime soon, but, you know.
Well, there are movements, the positive psychology
right, exactly.
movement, which does say, wait a minute.
Let's look
at people's strengths and not at mm-hmm. people's weaknesses. And does this address that at all?
The DSM really doesn't look at mental health. It's really looking at mental dysfunction and trying to, you know, carve out define all of the different kinds of mental dysfunction that exist.
And John Hamilton, and thanks very much for the call, Jim. And I get evidently the answer to your question is no. But as we look down the road, this period of comment and experimentation, this is going to be a vital period in the next few years.
Indeed, it will be. I mean, I think the comment period for over the next couple of months is going to be very interesting, because it's clear that there are, certainly from the people with autism and Asperger's, there's going to be a lot of feedback here, and a lot of these people bring up some really central issues. They point out, you know, here's why Asperger's, for instance, has been a good thing. Mm-hmm. for these people, and maybe that's reason enough to keep it. One of the interesting things I heard from some of the folks at the American Psychiatric Association is that they are going to consider all of those things, not just scientific things, but they are considering the social and political impact.
Which is really presents a potential problem for them, I thought, because, you know, I mean, one of the things that they've done, and you heard this with Dr. Kupfer, is said, look, this is a really scientific document. It's a It is science. So if they open it up to the floor and you get kind of interest groups, political interest groups, like, you know, like Asperger's interest groups or bipolar groups saying, no, don't make these changes. If they make the changes, will it undermine the scientific credibility of the document? That's part of the question.
And these are issues that Elise Spiegel and John Hamilton will be following for us on NPR News over the coming months. They're both science correspondents here, and we thank them for their time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Pleasure.